This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
This is Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. You're listening to an edited recording of this year's BFM Healthy Aging event by Sunway Medical Center.
We now come to our third panel session, and it's called The Heart. And to start off this session, I'd like to invite Lee Chui Lin, producer and presenter at the Evening Edition, followed by the speakers, Dato' Dr. Yap Yi Guan, consultant interventional cardiologist, Sunway Medical Center, Dr. Naresh Govinda Rajendran, consultant vascular surgeon at Sunway Medical Center, and last but not least, L. Mageswari Lachmanan, former head of dietetics and food services, Hospital Selayang, and deputy director, Allied Health Division, Ministry of Health.
So today we're going to be talking about a few things. We are going to be addressing firstly how the heart ages. Then we're going to be talking about what heart disease looks like, how to manage that. And then, of course, prevention, this issue of prevention and treatment. And I guess to start off with, how does the heart age? When we're talking about the cardiovascular system and aging, what does that actually look like?
Right. I think to answer these questions, perhaps if I may change the title of this session to, instead of saying heart, we should talk about cardiovascular system, which is why Naresh is here, because the heart is just a pump. But you have to think about the circulations, meaning the vasculatures, because they go hand in hand. So as far as the heart is concerned, as one gets older, a few things will happen to the heart itself. The heart muscle will get a bit thicker, a process that we call hypertrophy. So as the heart muscle gets thicker, it will dilate, the heart volume will increase. And at the same time, you might think that while the cardiac output, as we call it, the amount of blood that the heart pumps out in every minute should increase, but actually it decreases, partly because there's a reduction in the volume in the circulation as well, perhaps due to loss of fluid, if you like, hydrations as you get older. So the cardiac output actually drops. So that is what happens to the heart. But you also have to think about the vessel itself, the vasculatures, especially the aorta. The aorta will also undergo changes as you get older. Essentially, the aorta becomes stiffer. It becomes stiffer because there's a loss of elasticity of the aorta as a result of increase in collagen, decrease in elastin of the metrics of the aorta. And that's important because when that happens, the blood pressure, we call it systolic blood pressure, that's the top reading that you measure, will go up. At the same time, the diastolic blood pressure will go down. And that's important because, as you can imagine, as you may or may not know, the blood flow to our coronary arteries depends on the diastolic blood pressure. It's a passive flow. So you can imagine if the diastolic blood pressure drops as a result of aging, as a result changes to the aorta following aging process, the blood flow to the coronary artery will reduce. And the systolic blood pressure will go up, and that will then cause some insult to the aorta, and the aorta can undergo changes, it can split, it can rupture, and with atherosclerosis on top, you know, with food, unhealthy food that we eat, you can imagine this will become a perfect storm for something to happen. So can you imagine with this kind of processes that goes on with aging, and if you have a blocked arteries, then you're going to run into trouble. So that is basically what happens to the cardiovascular system in a nutshell as you get older.
Vessels is a tube. It's like any pipe at home. As time goes by, if you have a pipe, one of your hoses, you know, it gets blocked. It gets narrowed, it weakens. It's just a degenerative process. The same thing happens to vessels. As you get older, I mean, if you open one of your pipes at home and you take it down, you look, it's all been rusted all over, isn't it? The same thing happens. It becomes stiffer, it becomes harder, and that's what happens as you age. It just becomes like that. What you want to do is to slow that process down, and there are various ways which you can do that. Yeah.
Margus, I mean, clearly food plays a role here. How does one's food intake or food, how does one's diet need to change in order to account for this aging process?
First of all, just to compliment what Dr. Naresh and Dato said, if you look back into the piping system, if you're a plumber, you should see, because we see a lot of accumulation of the rust, we call. So why it get rusted? Okay, it's basically the food that you eat. Not today, yesterday, from the day you were born, actually, how your the mother fed the child, weaning diet, and when you are younger in the school, and you are when you are into the younger adult, and also going into married life, having children, that's where a lot of wonderful things will be happening. So it's basically about what food that you consume, the amount that you take. And basically, if you go into the detail of the food, of course, the fat. We are paradise for food, actually. As you mentioned, of course, not to mention the brand name, a lot of fried food available, and type of oil as well that we consume. And on top of that, we don't move much. The physical activities are very much lacking. A lot of people say, actually, the obesity runs in the family. The basic is nobody runs in the family for exercise. So that's a basic. It doesn't run in the blood. It is, it has in the, what you call, there's an effect of it, but it's not 100% because my parents was like that. It's basically our eating habits which make us what we are today from young age until now.
According to an anonymous questioner, the WHO has ruled out that cholesterol causes heart attacks and that there is no such thing as good or bad cholesterol. Is this true?
When it comes to cholesterol, cholesterol is needed for us because it is the basis for hormones and the other things. But only thing, when it become excessive, that's where it get accumulated into the blood vessels and can narrow down your arteries and can come to the cardiac events. And cholesterol, of course, there is a bad cholesterol and also good cholesterol. Who make it bad or good? It is actually, okay? If you consume the right type of fat, which is more of polyunsaturated, and you can get the good cholesterol to be in your body, which will draw away total cholesterol from the body and get eliminated. But we are accumulating the good cholesterol, the bad cholesterol, then it will accumulate into the blood vessels, which come from saturated fat, our favorite nasi lemak, roti canai, okay? But of course, public or the patient, they would not like to a dietitian to say, don't eat. When we say don't eat, they don't come and see us, actually. So now is the behavior therapy that you are looking at. You can eat, how you should eat. That how we should facilitate the public and also the patients. For example, nasi lemak. If let's say you must have nasi lemak to enjoy life, you can. But only thing, make sure you have it at home. When you cook your rice, you can have little coconut milk in it and replace with low-fat milk. It's still nasi lemak. Call it nasi lemak. When you cook your sambal, you don't put too much oil. Okay, and now there is a recommendation that we are using oil. We have to use oil somehow because we all cook with kuali. We don't do microwaving so much unless for heating purposes. So use your kuali, but make sure the oil is little and the type of oil that they're using. Palm oil can be used provided you have to buy 2 bottles now. You get your sunflower oil or other type of soya oil and you get another bottle of palm oil and mix it together in equal amount. That could be the best oil that you can use, but doesn't mean you can use it excessively, still within the limited amount. So you get to enjoy your nasi lemak, right? At the same time, it's cardiac protected. So that's how we should do modification. Nowadays, we don't tell no. Please enjoy, and this is how you should do it. Yes.
So obviously, aging is to be expected. And when that happens, changes kick in. How do you know when change is headed down the path towards disease? How do you know when change is headed down a situation that will turn out to be dangerous? What are the warning signs? What are the things that you should be looking out for?
See, more often than not, you don't have any signs. A lot of times, you don't have any signs because all these things occur very early in life, in your 20s and 30s, the changes in the vessels already happen. And you will never know what's going on until something happens. But there are symptoms. So for cardiovascular, for cardiac disease, you'll get chest pain, shortness of breath, things like that. For lower limb, for the legs, you can have pain when you walk. You can get pain in the thigh, the calf, tiredness, cramps. And in late stages, gangrene of the toes or ulcers and things like that. So a lot of times these things don't have symptoms. And when symptoms develop, a lot of times it's already quite far down the line and you already need treatment. So the main thing is actually prevention. You don't wait for things to happen. You prevent it early in life. And we're talking about preventing from the time you're in your 20s and 30s, not late in life. You start eating healthily, walking, you know, exercising and not smoking. I think that's what it should be, I think.
How often should people be going to visit the doctor for a heart checkup specifically?
I think that is a very broad question. It all depends on your risk factors. So in general, if you have the risk factor that I mentioned, and if you are a man and you have all those risk factors, if you are 40 years of age onwards, you should go for a heart checkup. And for ladies, if you have those risk factors, even if you have no symptoms and you are 45 years of age onwards, then you should go for a heart checkup. By heart checkup, again, it should include some blood tests to check your risk factors. You may think that I'm healthy, I don't have cholesterol, I shouldn't have diabetes, but you never know. But of course, if you have a family history of diabetes and hyperlipidemia and hypertension, of course, you're more likely to get that. But even if you don't have family history, lifestyle, as I say, diabetes, blood pressure, cholesterol is due to an interplay between genetic predisposition and a lifestyle or unhealthy lifestyle. So you may develop, diabetes, even if there's no strong family history of diabetes. So you should go for blood tests to check for all these risk factors, have your blood pressure measured. Smoking, obviously, you know whether you smoke or not. And then to check your heart, again, it depends on your risk profile. If your risk profile is not bad, you don't have many risk factors, then perhaps a simple stress test will suffice. But if you have multiple risk factors, you are heavy smokers, and you're older than I've just mentioned, the cutoff age that I've just mentioned, then perhaps you should go for a more detailed study, such as a CT scan and so on. But I will not obviously advocate everybody to go for a CT scan. We as the doctors, we have to select the high-risk group patients and then tailor the investigations accordingly.
So maybe Dr. Naresh, you can take this. What are the more common conditions that you observe in the older population in terms of the patients who come to see you?
Among the older population, probably more like for the vascular side, we look at peripheral vascular disease, which means peripheral vascular is basically narrowing of the arteries, usually in the leg. So what happens is they come in, they have pain in their leg when they walk, cramps, so they walk a distance. So normally they walk like 200 meters or 300 meters. Now they're walking 100 meters, then they're getting some pain in their buttock, the thigh, their calf. So those are the things that we see, and it's usually because of narrowing the artery. So when they at rest, they don't have pain. But when they start to exercise, when they walk up, uphill or walk up the stairs, they get pain. That's when you know there is something wrong. And sometimes people attribute it to, say, a knee problem. They say, oh no, it's just osteoarthritis and things like that. But it's actually a vessel problem. The other thing is cerebral vascular disease, which is basically arteries that go to the brain. So in the elderly, you get narrowing of the artery or hardening of the arteries in the neck, and they supply the brain. So these patients can actually come in with something called transient ischemic attack, where there are times where suddenly they have numbness of the hand or they can't move their hand and it goes off immediately, or they get spots in their eyes and they can't see sometimes and it goes back to normal. So basically what happens is there are clots from the neck going up to the brain and occluding in the brain, and that's a precursor, or that's a warning sign of a stroke that may come in, and that's worrying, and you got to get that treated, get that seen as soon as you can.
And Dr. Yap, I mean, in your older patients, I suppose, what are the things that you are seeing come up time and time again?
As one gets older, it's challenging for us to treat them. as far as cardiac diseases are concerned, be it coronary artery disease, valve disease, hypertension, and so on. So there are many things that we can touch on, which I'm afraid we may not have enough time, but perhaps I can just touch on a few things. As far as coronary arteries is concerned, block arteries, okay, or heart attack is concerned, in the elderly population, it's very challenging for us. Because on one hand, you look at the medical problem, you look at the vessels, and then you tailor your treatment accordingly. But that treatment may not be suitable for that particular person because of the age or advanced age, and because of comorbidities, because of the person's frailty. So it's very, very important these days for us as a cardiologist to look at the patient in a slightly more holistic manner. So we don't just look at the anatomy, the medical problems. We must look at the person as a whole, as we always should, but a lot of time we become too technical. So what I meant by that is that, let's say someone who is 82-year-old with a heart attack or with chest pain, and we did the investigation like an angiogram, we found that the person has triple vessel disease. And but the for a discussion purpose, let's say the person has triple vessel disease, but we can treat the problems with either multivessel angioplasty versus a bypass. So we have a choice here from the anatomical point of view. So which one should we recommend? So we have to sit down with the patient and discuss with the patient. Of course, we have to assess the person's physical status, the person's comorbidities, and most important, the person or the patient's preference. So time and again, a lot of time I told patients that, look, well, you got triple vessel disease, the traditional teaching is that go for bypass. Now, a lot of them will say, look, I'm 82-year-old, I'm 3-year-old, I don't expect to live up to 90, give me a few more years with my grandchildren, I'll be happy. Okay, so if that's their expectations, they just want to have another 3-4 more years of generally kind of a healthy, you know, years. So then, okay, fair enough. Then we should not, you know, perhaps be so rigid and subject them to a bypass that they may not want. Because bypass, don't get me wrong, I'm not saying bypass is bad or whatever. Bypass is very important, okay, as one of the mode of treatments for coronary artery disease. But bypass does carry with it mortality and morbidity. And in that situation, then we can look at the vessel and consider perhaps multivessel angioplasty, which carries a lower, you know, perioperative risk. But perhaps, just perhaps, you know, the longevity of the treatment may not be as long as a bypass. But then again, the person is 82 and the person wants to have a few more years. So we have to cater that according to the patient's preference. So when it comes to the technical side of the treatments, angioplasty itself is challenging in the elderly because, as I mentioned earlier, the coronary arteries are more likely to be calcified, the blockages are likely to be multiple and likely to be diffuse. Diffuse means very extensive. And that means we have to implant many stents. And not only that, it will increase the cost of the treatments, perhaps to the same level as that of a bypass. It also presents with us a lot of technical challenges, as well as complications of the procedure, such as kidney failure and bleeding and so on. So these are the challenges that we face when we come to treat elderly patients with coronary disease.
I think there's also this issue of medication because we hear stories of people who use medication as an excuse, therefore, to eat anything they want. And then on the flip side of that, you also have people who say, no, I have a very, very good diet, so I want to, you know, put off going on medication for as long as possible. What is that relationship between diet and medication? Should you always try to manage with diet first? You know, when do you just need to go in with a prescription?
I think it depends on whether you are referring to what we call primary preventions, meaning you prevent something from happening in the first place, or secondary preventions. By secondary prevention, we mean a person has already had an event, be it a heart attack, a stroke, or peripheral vascular disease. You want to prevent a recurrence event. So for primary preventions, let's talk about elderly people. By that, I mean perhaps people above 80 years of age. Now, in that age group, it's difficult. You have to look at individual risk factors and then tailor that accordingly. I think the key here is individual treatment for individual person, because everybody is different. You cannot have one size fits all. So let's say a person who is above 80 years of age with high cholesterol and never had an event. The person's cholesterol is, let's say, moderate, perhaps, say, around 6, which is quite common in Malaysia. At that age, perhaps I wouldn't be too hardline on them. Perhaps I wouldn't say, oh, you cannot eat your nasi lemak. You can have your nasi lemak, but the 3 ringgit basic one, not the one with the, you know, with the curries, with the sambal, with, you know, perhaps a squid, you know, thrown on top and so on, and perhaps double portion of rice. And so that definitely should not be the case. But perhaps, you know, basic nasi lemak should be fine. So because I think after all, we should let them enjoy their life. Otherwise, there's no meaning to life, as I always say to them. So that's fine. So if you are above 80, you never had a heart attack, your cholesterol is moderate, then okay, I'm a bit more relaxed. I'll let you, you know, be a bit more flexible with your diet. Now, at that age, I probably wouldn't give them statin to treat the cholesterol because, funny enough, we do not see any benefits in primary preventions for hypercholesterolemia in that age group. On the other hand, if they have already had a heart attack, that's a different story. So if you have already had an event, that's telling you that, you know, even at that age, you know, secondary prevention is important because by treating with a statin, that is, because the medicine like statins, you know, will not only lower the cholesterol, it will also stabilize the plaque to prevent recurrent, say, heart attack or stroke. So for secondary prevention, that's a different ball game. But you also mentioned about diet. Of course, that goes hand in hand. Diet and medications should go hand in hand. Otherwise, we should not, you know, diet and medication itself will not work if, you know, we don't watch our diet. Now, that's on the cholesterol part. For hypertension, again, different story. For hypertension, we should always treat. Perhaps at that in that age group, dietary control in itself is not going to be enough. Even if they don't eat salt, their blood pressure is going to be high because, as I mentioned earlier on to you, the vessel, the aorta, has already undergone aging changes, if you like. So the aorta is already very stiff. The systolic blood pressure is very high. By then, it's already 170, 180. So in that situation, you know, the hypertension is due to aging process. You will need medication. Dietary intake alone is, modification alone is not enough.
Magis?
Yeah, in terms of the management, and I think all diseases, including diabetes, hypertension, heart disease, stress, medication and the diet therapy has to come hand in hand, actually. So medication basically will try to, for example, for cholesterol, bring down your cholesterol. But if every day topping up with cholesterol from the food, at the end of the day, it doesn't get negative. It will always balance up. One side you are bringing out, the other side you are accumulating. So I think patients have to understand that when you're on medication, your diet therapy or the diet modification has to come hand in hand. It doesn't happen like it's not one prong kind of treatment. It has to together.
Thank you all very much for joining us today, and thank you all for your excellent questions.
We'll be back after a break for more from the panel discussion at this year's BFM Healthy Aging event by Sunway Medical Centre. Welcome back to Health and Living on the Bigger Picture. You're listening to an edited recording of this year's BFM Healthy Aging event brought to you by Sunway Medical Centre.
This brings us, ladies and gentlemen, to our final panel for today. This is called The Mind. Okay? And now I'd like to call upon the moderator for this session, the producer and presenter at The Bigger Picture, T. Xiao Ik, and the speakers, Dr. Syed Abdullah Al-Haddad, consultant neurosurgeon, Sunway Medical Center, Dr. Philip Poi Junhua, consultant geriatrician, Sunway Medical Center, and Aina Nur Azmi, clinical psychologist, Sunway Medical Center. This is The Mind. Take it away.
First, let's try to understand what's happening in the brain as we get older. So, Dr. Syed, I'm going to start with you first. How does the brain age? What's happening in the brain as we get older?
As we grow older, what would happen is our brain will go through what we call degenerative process. This essentially makes our brain functionally reduced. And to look at the overall structure of the brain, what would happen is structurally there's a shrinkage of the brain. So if you look at the if you imagine those strings are rivers, so now we've got lakes appearing within the brain. So when that happens, there's less land for us to work on. Yeah, this is where we need to look at the structural as well as the functionality. The functionality of it, there's also a reduction in some of the functions of the brain as we grow older.
Yes, the reason why you have memory loss or perceived memory loss is because you're all busy people. You've been accumulating experiences and memories for since day one of your birth. And you know there's a limit to what you can keep. And the more you learn, the more crowded the brain gets. The more accumulated knowledge you have, the more difficult it is to file them properly. Now, when you're young, everything was sharp. And when you're older, what happens is your visual memory and your explicit memory, that means the intention to remember, does decline with age. That means sometimes you see the place and you say, I think I've seen this before, but I can't remember clearly. And the intention to remember is like you want to go into a room and you say, I'm going to get something. And when you go through the doors, so that's where this is part of aging, that you have a little bit of that difficulty with intention to remember. Part of that problem is that when you get older, when you're in school, you're forced to remember all the time. But then after you graduate or after you leave school, the need to remember is only to remember who owes you money and who's your wife or husband. That's all you need to remember. The rest, you don't have to worry. So the tendency to intention to do so is not so well versed. You're less likely to remember so well. The second thing is that semantics, that means language skills, are not lost. Language skills are not lost. So that's one thing that's here. Recognition of faces are not lost. But if you have a situation like a reaction time, you'll find that you are slower with thinking it through. You can't remember, but after a while, it comes through.
What about the ability to learn new skills as you get older?
Learning new skills is all an attitude in the mind. If you want to, you can. It might take longer, but you can. Tun Siti Asma is a classic example. She picked up the violin at a very ripe old age, and she's now going to play the violin. And people can learn new musical instruments at any age. It's only whether you want to or not. So in a way, it's an attitude. So you don't stop learning if you can, because there's an opportunity to do everything. Yes, you know why you don't want to learn? Fear of failure. Lose face lah.
Speaking of the mentality towards life, I want to bring in mental health issues or mental health well-being as early as possible as well into this discussion. And Aina, what does it mean when we talk about being psychologically or emotionally well within the older age group?
To be mentally healthy means you are able to recognize your own potentials. At the same time, having the coping skills needed to manage your stressors in life and be productive. Most of us care so much about other people. We're very, very caring towards others, but we're very critical towards ourselves. When we do this, then we don't really see our own potentials. The only thing we focus on is, oh, I haven't done this. Oh no, I should have done that. Oh no. What am I doing with my life now? But we're very forgiving towards other people. So this is one thing that everybody has the potential of, whether realizing it or not, and whether
and
bring it out or not.
Do you see this more among older people who are caring, they have had to care for their children, they're looking at their grandchildren as well,
yep,
perhaps, so they're putting other people's needs ahead of theirs?
Exactly. That's very much in our care. Most parents would really feed their children first before feeding themselves. Yeah, so putting other people first is very much ingrained in most of us. Hence, looking inside or looking inwards is something very, very, very uncommon.
Just on the issue of the aging brain, we have a question on Pigeonhole, which is linked to something I wanted to ask as well. Is brain degeneration reversible? Or are we talking about delaying or reversing the brain's aging process? Is it possible?
Yes. Until recently, people Even in medical school, people used to tell me, you know, once your nerves are there, that's it. You know, you don't add any more nerves to it. But in recent times, in recent research, we found that there is what you call neuronal plasticity, which means that there's more and more nerves can be regenerated and built and grow. Now, in terms of how do we make things grow when you're older is either through nutrition and through practice. In terms of the same thing as you do with your muscles, when you want to have muscle, you know, you have to practice exercising and you have to have the right nutrition. If you don't eat well and you exercise, you won't get the muscle. So in the same way, brain has the same way. You have to practice in using the brain, but you have to have the right nutrition. Basically, you can actually improve your brain size. They see by using eating, having adequate amount of vitamin B complex, or B12 especially. B12. Now, B12 is normally present in your food, in meats as well. So, and you absorb it naturally, and that's not a problem. It may be a problem with vegans, pure vegans. That means those people who are total vegetarians, not lacto-fisco vegetarians, but those who are, they don't touch anything but green leaves only, and they might have a problem with B12 deficiency. So with pure vegetarians, they might have a problem with B12 deficiency, which may impact on their brain size. Not function, size. That means the hippocampus might be a bit smaller, which is where your memory is, but it doesn't affect your function. So I think it's important to realize nutrition, adequate nutrition, and regular practice. That means regular use of the brain like a muscle makes and maintains your brain function.
And speaking of exercises or practicing, Dr. Philip, you said we must keep our minds active. We must be using it all the time. We have a question here on Pigeonhole about activities to keep the brain active. Does a passive hobby like watching television help to keep our brain active? And I wanted to add on to that also with our obsession with being on social media now, that's constant scrolling and watching of YouTube and all that. What's the impact of that?
Shall we stick to TV first and then we talk about the scrolling?
Sure.
TV is definitely a passive sport. You watch, they talk to you, you can't talk back. So that's that, isn't it? It's not interactive. You're just passive. You're just taking it all in. Now, it's been shown that in a village in China quite a few years ago, they did a study on a village to find out who gets dementia and who doesn't get dementia. And they found that more people developed dementia had television sets at home than those who didn't. And that tells you one very important thing. It's not the TV that causes dementia. It's the lack of socialization. Socialization, to me, is the biggest crux in our society, in our whole human race. We are social animals. So now we talk about social media. Social media is another form of interaction. But this is a new form of interaction where you're looking for quick rewards. The quick reward of somebody responding to you. That means you send something and you say, oh, somebody gives you... or something like that, or whatever they say, huh? And that quick response is a approval of your statement, whatever you sent through social media. It's just approval. But they are all out there, you know, you don't know them at all, and you're not interacting in any deep way. It's a very superficial way. And I'm not so sure that social media is useful, because I think at the end of the day, the internet is useful for academics like those people in the universities, because that helps to help intellectual intercourse. But in terms of social intercourse, I think the internet is a slightly new situation that we are studying now. We are finding that people are starting to develop shorter and shorter attention spans.
I know, your thoughts on socialization within this context of getting older, how important is that?
Right. Like Dr. Philip mentioned, we are not a solitude being. We live among people and we need to be among people. Socializing, of course, some part of socializing perhaps with your child that lives 10,000 kilometers away, that would be good. But it doesn't, again, it's only on the superficial, never, it doesn't fit in to the real interaction you need. Hence, go out there, meet new people. Do not just stick to your phone. There's more to life than you think there are out there.
Dr. Syed, I'm going to pivot back to you to talk about stroke. How does old age increase the risk of stroke?
As you grow older, you acquire lots of other medical problems. These cumulative factors could predispose someone to develop stroke by narrowing the arteries. Now, to talk about stroke, there are essentially two types of strokes. One is what we call hemorrhagic stroke, and the other one is what we call thromboembolic stroke. Now, at the end of the day, the problem is essentially caused by damage to the brain and lack of nutrients and oxygen getting to the brain cells, therefore causing loss of functions of causing death of the cells. And thereby causing the loss of functions. This problem is more common because of the narrowing of the blood vessels, and then the blood vessels become quite friable, easily damaged. So that's where you get these two essentially major problems.
And so with a stroke, we always talk about how important it is to get treatment as early, to be able to identify the signs of a stroke as early as possible and institute treatment. Can you just very quickly explain the signs again? Things that could be mistaken as being benign that we don't want to miss out.
Okay. I think just remember, be fast. Yeah, and I think you probably, some of you guys probably seen the word, the acronym FAST. I just say be fast, B-E and fast, be fast. B for loss of balance, E for erratic behavior, F for facial weakness, A for weakness of the arm and slurred speech, and time. Now, and I think and just to go back, so be fast. Yep, and if you see any of these symptoms or signs, just, you know, what you need to do is try to seek medical attention as soon as. Now, the main worry that the one thing I've also noticed in Malaysia is sometimes, for especially among the Chinese community, I've seen patients who come in with these symptoms, very clear-cut symptoms of suggestive of stroke, and then is about, you know, they presented to me about 3 or 4 hours down the line. Because the essence of this is it's about the neuronal loss. So if you delay it, you're going to harm the cellular functions and then could cause the subsequent cell death. So it's vitally important for you to seek medical attention as soon as you've as soon as you suspect there's a stroke development. And it is important for you to seek the medical attention within the first hour of the presentation, because the earlier you seek the attention, the greater the outcome, the less likely for you to develop long-term complications from stroke.
And speaking of the long-term complications, because if there is a delay, it's going to cause damage to certain parts of the brain, and that's where you will later see issues with paralysis and speech, swallowing and all that. Could we look at post-stroke complications from the perspective of the elderly person, the complexities of managing that in someone who is older? And Dr. Philip, do feel free to chime in, but you know, when a stroke affects a person's physical mobility, what kind of risk do we need to manage, especially for an older person?
I think this particular problem is rather complex, because not only is it going to affect the patients, it's also going to affect the people surrounding them, the caregivers. So it certainly depends on the severity of the problem. I think the stroke, when you see these people, because it's essentially a sudden event. I've had patients who essentially was out enjoying themselves, going for a walk in the morning, and in the afternoon they were bedridden. So it's find it difficult because there's no chance for them to accept the sudden change in their life. So it is. I'm sure it will affect the psychological aspect of it. The caregivers, will find it difficult to, because they're essentially unknown in terms of the support they're going to get. There are many, lots of unknowns within the actual problems.
Stroke in an elderly person is a catastrophic event. You know that because you're not young, and so it's harder for you to regain function. So it's a really big problem, because your spouse, probably the same age as you, and because they're the same age, and if you're 80 and she's 75, it's hard for them to look after you. So I always focus on trying to prevent stroke rather than worry about after the stroke, because once it's happened, then there's a whole new ball game for everybody. Whole new ball game. Prevention of stroke to me is more important. So it's so important to watch out for your blood pressure. And one thing I want to ask you, Sain, does drinking enough water help prevent strokes? Because I always have the theory that you don't drink enough water when you get older because you don't like the inconvenience of the toilet visits.
Yeah, I have no doubt it would. What happens is we initially talked about the clogging of the blood vessels. Sometimes when there's lack of water within the body, it can the blood become thickened, and so increases the likelihood of you developing a stroke. And I think water is probably the cheapest medicine you can get. I always say that in the hospital, this single bottle will cost about probably a ringgit. The one that hangs next to your bed will cost you about 100 ringgit. So choose which one. It would also reduce the risk of you developing stones, renal stones. So there are many, this is a fantastic medicine. I would encourage people to drink at least 2 liters of water a day.
There is a calculation to that. So in case of, if you're not sure how much to drink, you go and weigh yourself and you multiply by 30 mils per kilogram per day. If you don't have heart failure, if you don't have kidney failure, that is what you need, minimum amount of water you need every day.
And can we look at dementia now, Dr. Philip? We've got the highest ranking question on Pigeonhole. Is there a drug to delay the onset of dementia?
There is no drug yet. We are working hard on this, okay? We've been working hard on this since Ronald Reagan. But what I can tell you is what we know now is we've done, several researchers in Finland have done a study called the Finger Study, which suggested that if you control things in midlife and you really have to watch out for your the factors that can affect you and increase your risk of getting dementia. And these are your blood pressure, your cholesterol, and things that you can't change, which is your sex and your age. You can't change that. But you can change one more thing. You can control for your intellectual abilities. The more studying you do, the less likely you are to get dementia. Push yourself to learn more. Make sure your blood pressure is in the right range and ensure that your cholesterol is under control, especially those who have had warning signs, heart attacks and all that sort of thing before. Oh yes, one more thing. Diabetes is a big problem. So please make sure you check for your sugars as well.
I know I've mentioned about the two major events, the thromboembolic or the block arteries and hemorrhagic stroke. There's also another group of people, what we call silent stroke. These are the people whom the doctors and themselves do not didn't realize that they've had the stroke. These are small strokes that over a period of time could cause problems with dementia. So going back, I think these are the things that we could do to prevent it from happening, i.e., again, to drink plenty of water.
It seems very simple. Aina, how do we look at issues like dementia within the context of mental health? First of all, what are the dangers of dementia being confused with depression? Does that happen often, and how can we distinguish them?
It does. WHO reported that in elderly, especially, many elderly who show symptoms of depression or any mental health issues goes untreated. And some might see it as not just dementia, like, you know, joint pains or headaches. And because of this, thinking that, oh, it's just physiologically, not to add with emotionally. Now, when someone is depressed or going through low mood for a certain period of time, we're talking about 2 weeks or more, feeling very, very empty, feeling very, very like low motivation, low hope, low of appetite, your sleep pattern is disturbed. Part of it is self-neglect. Self-neglect is when you don't really care of how you look, whether you've eaten or not, again, part of it. And because of this, you have a lot on your mind that causes this to happen, of course. And then when you are not able to capture new information or to retain them, and hence most people think, I think I'm getting old. I'm forgetting things. It could be I have dementia. So it's not necessarily it. Few symptoms to pay attention to. When you are depressed or when you're feeling low mood, you can't retain new information. Not to say you can't retain new information, you can't concentrate. And once you can't concentrate, you won't be able to remember. And then, but the thing is, what's the difference between dementia and stress is that you know that there is a problem there. Someone who are going through dementia might not even know it's a problem. You know, they put the remote control in the fridge and then they say, well, they don't even care because they don't know it was a problem. But when you realize, hey, something is wrong, why am I forgetting things? One of it is when you're very stressed, the mental capacity to remember, it declines very fast. With dementia, it's gradual.
What causes an older person to face these stressors? What are the aspects in their life that we need to look at that will be contributing to mental health issues?
Right. Now, health is one, physical health. Loss of job, for example, loss of child, loss of partner. And when you remember all this factor or changes that happens in your life, it's all related to losing something. So when you lose something, you're going through grief. So I think in most of our culture, we understand grief as dying. But losing something that used to be yours, losing your functionality, part of losing that is also grief. You're grieving over the loss. So if I can explain a little bit more about what grief is. So grief is a process, and there are 5 stages to grief. So first is when a reality hits you or a news being brought over to you and a new reality comes, and the first thing that comes to mind is denial. It could not be, it shouldn't be, perhaps it's not. Let me try again, let me find out more. And then after denial, then you realize, oh no, I'm very angry. Why does it happen to me? I've always tried to take care of my health. Why does it happen? Why does it happen now? Then after being angry, after some time, then you start to then compromise. Let me try and get help. Let me find out more about it. Let me do something about it. But after some time, trying and trying, nothing change. And then you get into depression mode, whereby you go, oh, what's the point? nothing changed, even if I try hard enough. And then after that, you come into acceptance, whereby you realize that, okay, you accept and you acknowledge, and then you move on from there. Now, getting to acceptance, the stages is not as simple as it is, and there's no time frame for you to say, ah, you've grieved for a long time now, it's time to move on. It's not as simple as that. And going through the stages of life, what happens is because expectations doesn't meet reality. When expectation doesn't meet reality, so it causes a lot of mental disturbances, or no, emotional distress. Because what you believe to be so, or what you know to be so, is not like that anymore. So accepting the new reality is part of accepting your current self.
Could we get a wrap-up from each of you, a takeaway message?
Going back to what Dr. Philip mentioned earlier about the about being in groups, and I think it's vitally important. You know, your exercise, the qigong in the afternoon with your mates, will be very, you know, good way to exercise, and then not only exercise your body, exercise your mind as well. Yeah, but I think we'll try to live positively, healthily, and hopefully we'll age gracefully.
Drink more water. Please.
Life will be filled with surprises. Life will be filled with stressors, or stress even. You can never have a stress-free life. Anyone who were to tell you, do this in order to lead a stress-free life, that's a fraud. What you need to do, or what we need to tell ourselves is, how do we manage all these things that come to us? How do we get support from it?
Yeah. You've been listening to an edited recording of this year's BFM Healthy Aging event, presented by Sunway Medical Center, celebrating 20 years of care. This has been Health and Living on the Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.